Hello, hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Show. I am your host, Nicholas Lorimer, and today I'm joined by Sargon. Sara, how are you doing? I see you've been having strange internet problems recently. Is the lightning or wind or whatever been causing problems?
I usually have great internet connectivity, but I think as soon as the weather changes, you know, if you have rain, the cables, whatever. So I'm going to try and hang on here.
And I hope everyone in the Cape is managing to stay weighed down with all that wind blowing about. Michael, are you managing to stay weighed down?
Yeah, pretty much. Fortunately, where we are, we've been relatively untouched by the high wind. But it's just a few kilometers away, I think it's been quite rough. So I'm very lucky. Yeah.
Indeed. So, hopefully the weather doesn't get too crazy. But I must say, I am rather enjoying Joburg's cool and slightly rainy today. It is a rather pleasant autumn day. That being said, let us get into our first news story of today. And this is a wonderful piece written by our former colleague, Gareth van Onselen, who is busting one of my most hated myths, or rather he's taking on something that feeds into one of my most hated parts of politics, which is youth politics. And before I get to the point, I'll just say that youth politics has always irritated me in a very special way, because it is of all the forms of identity politics, it's the sort of laziest. Absolutely everyone is young once, and being young doesn't really identify you as much, except that you're overly emotional and not that bright. but maybe I'm just too harsh. Since I was about 18, I've thought that the voting age should be 25, but I will... You know, that's not a hill I'm willing to die on. So let's get into this piece that Gareth Nonson wrote. It's titled Busting the Disillusioned Youth Myth. And he goes into a pretty lengthy examination of what in South Africa we sometimes call the youth vote or youth activism, or how much young people are engaged with the political system. He starts off, and I'll quote him here, "There is a popular narrative among certain political commentators, primarily on social media, that the youth do not vote in large numbers because they are disillusioned as opposed to apathetic. In other words, while the youth are intensely political, their opting out thus should be blamed on political parties and their leaders who have failed to capture the youth's imagination." So he basically talks about, firstly, why we should make this distinction between disillusionment and apathy. He basically says disillusionment is when you care, but you know, you're just so unhappy with the way things are going or your options that you decide not to take part. It's almost like a form of protest. Whereas apathy is when, you know, you just don't really give a damn. And we don't really know why you don't give a damn, but you know, you don't give a damn. He talks about how it's very silly, first of all, to think of the youth as some kind of homogenous bloc, because they are not. There are, of course, many young South Africans. Although we are an aging society, we are still relatively, compared to a lot of more developed countries, quite a young society. Although we are seeing things like reductions in family size and that kind of stuff now, which suggests that in the future we are set to age quite a lot more. But, you know, young people actually often don't have that much in common. They often identify along lines that are much more complicated than just youth. They identify via their sort of class background or their racial background or their gender background or their what they do for work or whether they're studying or whether they're unemployed, something like that. So it's kind of a bit silly to talk of them as anything like a homogenous group. He then goes into examining the actual data and the trends of youth apathy, disillusionment, that kind of thing. And he finds that, generally speaking, South Africans, there is good statistical evidence to suggest that South Africans have become, in general, more disillusioned with the political system. And this is not just young people, but it's actually across the entire political spectrum. But interestingly, when you ask people whether they have faith in institutions, for example, democracy, you tend to find that older people are actually more skeptical of government institutions, whereas young people are more optimistic about them, which is kind of the opposite of what one would think if you thought the youth were massively disillusioned. He comes to the conclusion, essentially, at the end here, that you know, there are many factors at play with why young South Africans really aren't voting in absolutely enormous numbers, at least compared to the older generations. But generally speaking, apathy is a big part to play in that. And that's not to be unexpected. Apathy is very much a part of every political system, particularly when it comes to young people. You can go to almost any country in the world and you will find that if it is a democracy, old people tend to vote and young people tend not to. Michael, I know I've gone on a bit of a monologue here, but what do you make of all this story? Do you agree with Gareth, what Gareth is saying? Do you agree with my dislike of youth politics? What do you think?
Yeah, I think both are true. I think the very first thing to be said is this excellent essay on insidepolitics.org, if you want to go and look it up, is a wonderful illustration of the irreplaceable virtue of proper intellectual inquiry, research, and a willingness to test every proposition, to look at the data, to think about things, to think about the words that are used. There's a very subtle distinction between disillusionment and apathy, as we were saying in the discussion before the show. But it's an important one. And before commenting on some detail, just to come to his very last two paragraphs, Gareth says it's important to interrogate the myth of youth disillusionment. Because, as he puts it, an entire industry has grown up around it and in response to it, from NGOs to media campaigns to political parties, all accept this narrative unquestioningly. And then his final point, which I think is just so fundamental and very important, democratic participation is a two-way street, and so much is focused on political party responsibility, so little on personal responsibility. He says, if the youth are to become engaged adults and not perpetual children, let's be candid and blunt about this, the narrative about them needs to become more grounded in facts, more sophisticated, and at least to some degree hold the youth jointly responsible for their actions. I mean, there's so many different things that he raised that would be great to talk about, but somewhere in the report, he makes the point that, you know, a hell of a lot of attention is focused on the first cohort to come into an election year, the 18, 19-year-old cohort, their first election is a big thing. Yet, in fact, as he points out, these people represent just 2% of registered voters, 3% of South Africa's population, and they've never been more than 4.5% of the population. So this is not a category of people that we need to really to fret about and to go into crisis mode over. This is, you know, relatively small, and as you pointed out, this is an international issue. Young people, I think, probably tend to think that they can get on with their lives without all this adult stuff that, you know, has ruined the world, has ruined their history, is responsible for everything that's wrong. As they grow up, they begin to realize that they're in fact part of this whole enterprise, and also that to change it, they also need to actually get involved and do the hard work. I think there's a great deal of idealism among young people, which is absolutely wonderful. But in the absence of a kind of sense of realism and pragmatism, you actually can't get to grips with how to change society and how to make changes. And changes do happen because responsible adult people step up to the plate, form political parties, do the canvassing, do the hard work behind the scenes, become MPs, write better legislation, vote for it, get other people in society to vote for you. That's actually how all the great change in society actually occurs. So, yeah, I mean, a lot of different things, but I think he deals with this absolutely brilliantly. There are, you know, millions of young people. Quite interesting, he notes that 52% of the 22 million South Africans who are in the 18 to 39 category, 52% are registered, 48% are not. But as you point out, Nicholas, I think it's also true, or it's also important to emphasize the degree of whether it's disillusionment or apathy among adults. There are lots of adult South Africans who've also reached this point where they're not quite sure whether it's worth, you know, participating in elections and so on. We know otherwise. This is the way to do it. We are a constitutional democracy. We have the freedoms. We have the institutions. We must use them. And we need to hold the youth to account in exactly the same way and, you know, p- put it before them that this is actually, they are agents, no less than we are, and their youth doesn't give them any special rights to just walk away from it and pretend it doesn't affect them.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. And you know, it's to be expected as you become more invested in society, you know, get into a job, you get into a more stable long-term relationship, you maybe buy property or rent property or kind of settle in an area, you're going to be more invested in politics because it actually does affect you more in terms of everything from taxes to making a living to looking after your own kids, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But I like the point that you raised about the sort of extended adolescence thing and that Gareth also mentions is that you know, we give 18-year-olds a lot of rights. That's when you become a legal adult, you can vote, you can do all these things. And yet there's still this tendency, and you particularly see it towards university students, to kind of baby people. You know, it's like, oh, shame, you know, the youth, they're just so sweet and innocent and young, as though everyone was like 13 or 14 rather than in their, you know, 18, 19, sure. 20. If you have the right to vote, then there should be some societal expectation that you exercise that properly. If you have the right to make important financial decisions for your life, to decide on your life, you should be treated like that. And I believe that if you do treat people more seriously and responsibly, firstly, in the long run, they'll appreciate it more. Because no one really likes to be babied that much. And also, it sort of helps people to grow up. This continued victimhood and adolescence stuff, it's a trend we see in so many different ways in our politics, but seeing it applied to young people is, I always think, particularly silly. Sara, what do you make of this whole debate? I know you're also probably a bit of a fan of this idea too, but what are your thoughts?
There are two great clichés in politics, and particularly in South African politics. The one is that the youth complaining that the adults don't know what they need or want. So politics isn't aimed at them. And the other one is that, you know, we all know that the brains of the youth aren't really fully developed until 25, which means that all of the things you've spoken about apply. Inexperience, immaturity, an extraordinary sense of self that's often misplaced. And those only really change as you grow older and you become responsible. And that's why the age group that's 30, I think talking about 18 to 39 is a bit wide. I think 18 to 25 is probably more appropriate, because after that, people do tend to get the real life experience, however harsh their upbringing may be, the real life experience of the fact that you may not be interested in politics, or you may not think that politics is worthy of your attention, but politics is interested in you. And absolutely everything, almost everything that the ANC has done legislatively has negatively impacted. But, you know, you have to accept that that is not a youth thing. And yes, we do know what youth need and what youth want, because they're generally the same things as we need and we want. And we also are usually the parents of youth who know desperately what youth wants. So youth are overrated.
If I can very slightly change the topic here, I think another really important piece of this Gareth piece kind of talks about, and you know, there is a space in political analysis and political discussion and opinion, like what we do on the show, for speculation. There's a space for kind of theory crafting and all sorts of stuff like that. But at the end of the day, nothing really substitutes for looking at empirical evidence where it may be found, you know, and it's not always available, but where you can find it, using what you have and making an argument based from that. And I think that's one of the really good things about this Gareth piece here, is it reminds us, you know, that so often in our political discourse, we talk at length about this issue or that issue, but we really actually miss the point because we haven't based our arguments or discussions on empirical data. I mean, when it comes to race relations, we at the IRR often have this problem that our surveys of South Africans show they hold a particular view of race and cooperation and merit and all these things. And yet our political discussion kind of continues on as though that's not really the case. Michael, any final thoughts on this topic?
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. And, it's also quite interesting how, I mean, the two quotes that he begins his report with, both from people arguing that that to talk about youth political apathy is lazy in the case of one, and is just inaccurate in the case of the other. And he, you know, he highlights the fact that both these two people refer to there being a fair amount of political activity among young people, which is absolutely true. But that's very different. It's a very different proposition to say, you know, students mobilizing to demand this or that or the other thing is equivalent to their being politically engaged. And I think that's a very important distinction to make. But, you know, as you rightly emphasize, it's in the detail of his research that he brings out the virtue, as I began by saying, the virtue of proper intellectual inquiry is looking at the facts, weighing up the data, looking at the numbers, looking at the trend lines. And again, people who are interested in this topic, we should really go and have a look, because it's very detailed, it's very interesting, it's written in a very measured way. It's a great piece of work. And very important, an important reflection on our society. I think so often in South Africa, in South African political debate, we tend to shift from one position to the next on the basis of panics and kind of moral anxiety about things. But in fact, you know, we're a democratic society plodding along, much like most democratic societies do. We have a government that's, as Sara has said, is desperately failed people and really bad policies, and now we're in the political process of changing that. We you know, as a society, we're moving on, and it's a, you know, quite a prosaic thing in a way, but it's not the headline version of South African politics.
You know, day to day dramas do certainly shift the needle one way or the other, but at the end of the day, it is those long term trends that often have far bigger of an impact on how things are going to turn out.
And just to highlight another thing that Sara said, is that parents actually are very in tune with what concerns young people. And of course, the other point, just to make it, partly because we're paying for it, you know, we're paying for so much of what they're doing. That's just how it is. So we are invested. As we should be.
Indeed. One last thing I just want to say on political engagement at universities. I think, you know, university youth probably are a bit more politically engaged than most other young people. But even there, you know, the participation, for example, in student representative council elections on campuses is very often 30% or below in terms of the total number of eligible voters, students. And when we're talking about university students, we're also talking about relatively small chunk of the population, sort of like maybe 10%, something like that.
There was actually one other thought that I hadn't made up my mind about, but I think it's quite an interesting idea, is whether young people, well, on the one hand, I think young people do think they know better. I think Sara was saying something, and they know better than adults, so they kind of don't need our stuff. Parties and democracy and all that nonsense. They can do it on their own. But I mean, in this country, I do have wonder whether there is a broad portion of young people whose lives are actually immeasurably better than the lives of their parents. This is it's a credit of our political change over the past 30 years. And perhaps they do feel that they really don't need policy and, you know, all the hard graft and the sweat and the drafting of alternatives and the thinking about and the engaging in politics, that they just feel that, you know, they've got this, to use this cliche, and that they can do it. But, you know, whether this is a reflection of this, of a young society that's actually probably, you know, not in such a bad place, certainly in terms of university students, who are not necessarily the majority of it. I think they're probably an elite in a way. But one wonders, whether that's just a factor.
That is an interesting thing to think about, because often when people vote or make political changes or sort of switch the way they're moving in politics, it's often comparative and sort of in line, you know, it's got more to do with people's expectations in their absolute situation, something like that, which can, I think, was one of the reasons why you can say, well, but people are fairly well off, but they can still be angry because maybe their expectations were that they'd be better off. That's often the thing that happens in politics. Many of history's revolutions happen actually when things go on a bit of an uptick and then have a slight downturn because people's expectations are dashed. And that's what really makes them angry. But anyway, so as you can see, we have a lot of thoughts on this topic, but we will, I'm sure, return to it at another time. But that doesn't mean that you shouldn't go to pledgetovote.co.za. And we're not speaking, we're not just speaking to the youth, but to all the people who listen to this podcast. Please do go check out that website and pledge to vote in the 2024 election on the 29th of May. It's an important election for our country, and you know, political apathy, political disillusionment, I don't think is really going to change the way that things are running in this country. Active, committed citizens getting involved and making their voice heard will make government more reflective of what they believe. Okay, let's move on to our next topic, and this is an article in the Daily Maverick where they make an interesting comparison between our Minister of International Relations, Naledi Pandor, and former Foreign Minister of South Africa, Piet Buerta. And the comparison they make is that both of them went to the United States at various times in an attempt to win the Americans over to their cause, but ultimately will probably fail. In the case of Piet Buerta, he did fail to win the US over to him. And Naledi Pandor looks set to probably fail to win over the US to South Africa's point of view. There's a lot that goes into this article. One of the points they raise is that South Africa is just not as important as it used to be. That's partly because South Africa has spent the last decade in a sort of period of stagnation economically. Our military has declined quite significantly, so we don't have that sort of muscle force on the African continent anymore. But also it's because there are other African countries that have developed in a lot of ways. And even though they still have major problems, their economies and infrastructure are vastly better than they were 30 years ago. So Kenya and Nigeria are far more important political players on the African continent than they were back in 1994. So, Sara, let me start with you. I mean, I think this article is pretty much right that the South Africa and the ANC in particular is kind of got this sort of incoherent foreign policy of trying to play nice with the West, particularly the US, which is generally speaking our sort of second or third biggest trading partner, and Europe, which is our biggest trading partner if you take all of its all of the EU members together. We sort of know that they're important for our economy, but at the same time, whenever it comes to those sort of questions of what political bloc we're going to line up in the world politics, whether it be with China or the US, we almost always seem to, you know, back Venezuela or China or Zimbabwe or, you know, one of the US's enemies. And the Americans are beginning to notice.
I think Naledi Pandor is harnessing her inner pick. But there are two, and in both, as you say, with regard to location and economy, the only problem is that I think Pitt knew that he was sort of winging it because the opposition to apartheid was became so profound, and the pressures on the West to stand up against apartheid, which ultimately the United States did. He had nothing. He had to try and sell the location and the economy. The problem for Pandor and the ANC is that they are responsible for the fact that we are neither the gateway to Africa, nor does our economy offer anything attractive. And in fact, everything's gone down. I mean, particularly for the sort of favored subsidized areas like car manufacture. And it's like, you know, the Pandor's following a playbook that says, if there's a right way to do it, we'll do the opposite. I mean, that's actually the hallmark of ANC policymaking in the last, say, 10, 15 years. We have nothing to offer the States. And what we don't have, which we had when we went into things like AGOA, is we just don't have the sort of emotional political heft that we once had. We had under Mandela and to a lesser extent, but still had with Mbeki. We have nothing to offer anybody, and that's because we have had nothing to offer the people of South Africa for so many years. That we're not talking about totally about emotion. We're talking about self-interest. every country has a level of self-interest, and our self-interest should not be entirely aligned to the autocrat in the East. But since we've nailed our colors to that mast, the moneyed West has said, you know, don't support us in the UN, slag us off all the time, don't have anything to offer, offering less and less. We are not a reliable investment destination, which even some others who are less democratic, at least investors know where they stand. So she's on a hide into nothing, I think, at this point. I think we don't have what it takes. And the government, I'm not entirely sure to what extent they realize it. Pick had to realize, Pick knew. I mean, you know, he was candy, if nothing else. I'm terrified that neither Pandor nor her colleagues know.
So there's two points I just want to make, kind of reinforcing what you just said. One is that, you know, if South Africa's economy was growing at 5%, 7%, we would really be in a different situation. The US would actually have to play nicer with us, because they would say, okay, well, this isn't a country that's only going to become more important. It's a country that's on an upward trajectory. And so, yes, they don't agree with us on a lot of foreign policy issues, but, you know, we sort of have to take them seriously. But while we're trying, you know, as we go to the US to try and win them over to us, we're also saying, oh, and we're going to allow expropriation without compensation. We're going to gut our health sector with the national health insurance. Our economy has been, you know, limping along between 1% and 3% growth for the last at least 10 years. This is not a position of strength from which to argue. So, you know, those self-interested sort of realist positions might have shifted the US to be more favorable towards us, and the ANC could have whatever foreign policy it liked, but they've weakened the country so much economically that they just can't fall back on that as the sort of cudgel that it might have been in the middle of the Mbeki years, you know, or rather towards the end of the Mbeki years in like 2005, when, you know, the economy was growing at sort of 5-6%. But another point this article makes, and this I think goes into what you were saying about our sort of moral credibility, you know, that came after 1994. 1994 united a lot of people against it, not just because of, you know, the racism of the apartheid system, but also because it was seen as an important movement in favor of democracy in Africa. And South Africa championed itself, particularly under Mandela, and whether this was entirely true or not is up for debate, but the sort of image that was widely believed, particularly in the West, was that South Africa was this great democracy-promoting positive force. But our foreign policy record has not shown that. There's so many places where South Africa has just very nakedly sided with authoritarians, just because that's sort of where South Africa, where the ANC's kind of ideological heart lies. You know, that really has eroded our moral authority on the world stage. Michael, what do you make of all of this?
I absolutely agree with this last point, especially the line in the Greg Mills and Ray Hartley piece. The ANC no longer has the wiggle room it once enjoyed. South Africa is now judged as any other country and is being found wanting. Just Sunday, on the BBC, BBC interviewed Jens Stoltenberg, the head of NATO, who pointed out that there was what NATO perceives to be an alliance of authoritarian powers that is working increasingly closely together against Western interests. And he particularly mentioned China, Russia, Iran, and North Korea. Now, you just look at South Africa's position in the world in relation to China, Russia, and Iran, three of those mentioned, and you begin to realize how America must be viewing us, and the grave disquiet that our positions and our public pronouncements on so many things must cause. And no amount of PR is going to overcome that. You know, this is a substantive issue. They're going to judge us on what we say, the relationships we have, the relationships we appear to favor, that we're willing to nurture. And they must, you know, those publics, the Western democracy, the publics of the Western democracy must be asking themselves, you know, what exactly is South Africa doing? Where are they placing themselves? Is it with this alliance of authoritarian powers, as NATO has called it, or is it with us? You know, their biggest trading partner. So it becomes a substantial material factor, which South Africa can't wish away or erode with PR ventures and missions to foreign capitals.
Look, personally, I'm not hugely in favor of a neutral foreign policy for South Africa, but I think there's a very strong argument to be made that South Africa has a lot to gain economically and politically from sort of trying to balance itself in a position of neutrality between these two emerging power blocks on the world stage. I think the next decade is going to be increasingly tense as these two power blocks compete more aggressively with each other and maybe even come to blows, although hopefully not. But the thing is, in order to maintain a sort of neutral position, which is officially what the ANC government's foreign policy is a position not of alignment but of neutrality. You have to be quite deft, you have to be diplomatic, you have to vote abstain a lot. You can't just indulge your sort of desire to, criticize the West as evil capitalist big dogs whenever you want. But the ANC government doesn't seem capable of doing that. Sarah, final thoughts on this?
Yeah, I think deft has been replaced by daft, because I mean, certainly the sense is that China's not as engaged. It's discovered that the developing world can't pay its debts to China. So, China and Russia are not, their interests are very distinct, and I'm not sure South Africa entirely understands what they are. But probably the best example of a country that is managing that balance to a considerably better extent is India. India doesn't always support what the West wants, but it is growing, and its economy is growing, and it
Exactly.
is and China and India is looking in the right directions. So, our diplomacy has always been shambolic, and now it's
Right.
shambolic laced with an ideology that's about 60, 70 years past its sell-by date.
And that's why India needs gets to be in BRICS and also get visits from both Donald Trump and Joe Biden, or not necessarily visits, but overtures of friendship and warmness and loveliness and cuddliness, because they put themselves in a strong position. Anyway, let us move on very quickly to our last story. Not much that we have to say about this one, but the city of Ekurhuleni looks like its council may be headed for some sort of dissolving. Or at least the city might be placed under administration. And this is because the ANC and EFF coalition appears to have finally collapsed in the municipality. The mayor, who was part of the AIC, has been removed. But the speaker, who is a member of the EFF, seems to be delaying holding a new election for mayor. The Gauteng Cooperative Governance and Traditional Affairs, MEC, warns that the city of Ekurhuleni is facing dissolution if a new mayor is not elected soon. It's not clear whether anyone is going to be agreed upon to be the new mayoral candidate. And the National EFF and National ANC don't seem to be really, at least publicly, throwing themselves into this fray too much. Sarah, what do you make of all this?
Oh, I think the winner will be the EFF's best friend, our Premier Panyaza Lesufi, because he's dying to have cities in Gauteng under provincial administration. And I think one underestimates his the extent of his relationship with the EFF. And he's also, not what I would call the candidate of choice. So the EFF and the ANC, I don't know who's playing the clever game. I suspect it might be, the EFF holds out and the ANC is not deft enough to respond appropriately.
We'll have to keep a close eye on it because, of course, how things go in Ekurhuleni will be an interesting mirror on how things may go after the 2024 election. Michael, any final thoughts on this?
Perhaps I need to say, without being too smug, that I'm pretty happy to be living in the Western Cape. It does look rather dire. But we have the Gauteng Cooperative Governance, MEC, Mzi Khumalo, saying that political gimmicks are not helpful. Well, this is absolutely true. But as Sarah says, we've got to watch this quite closely. It's just part of a kind of grander plan to have the provincial sway being extended to cities. So who knows? We're going to require maximum vigilance and and tightening of seat belts, I'm sure, on the part of people living there, which is a shame.
Can I just tie the first topic to the third topic? And perhaps we need a serious rethink of the civic education our children receive at school.
Yeah, that's definitely, I think, a major issue is that you know, civic education is very bad. That's not just a South African problem, but I think it's one that is a very serious one that does need to be tackled, because particularly young people really don't know that much about how our political system works. And that's maybe a part of why they're kind of apathetic. But anyway, that is all the time we have for today. I hope that you found this show interesting. And we shall see you tomorrow on the Daily French Show. Cheers, everyone, and have a wonderful day.